Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. HIV swept through world populations with deadly and frightening apparent speed, but its origins probably date back decades to bloody animal-human encounters in the African bush. Field biologist Nathan Wolf is on the hunt for the next viral killers to spot them before they go pandemic. He's tracking them down in the rainforests of Cameroon, in Malaysia, in China, and beyond, and to the blood of hunters who kill wild game. This hour, On Point Virus Hunters, Nathan Wolf. Wolf, the Global Viral Forecast Initiative, and the quest to stop the next pandemic. You can join the conversation. Does this sound incredible, possible to build a surveillance network so deep in rainforest and bush and the lives of hunters that it spots the next deadly virus before it breaks out? Joining me now from Stanford, California, is Nathan Wolf, director of the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative, a pandemic warning system which works with more than 100 scientists and staff around the world, including in Cameroon, China, Malaysia, and more. He's a field biologist and visiting professor of human biology at Stanford University. He spent more than 8 years in Southeast Asia and sub-Saharan Africa tracking the movement of viruses. Nathan Wolf, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
I wish you'd take us back to the story of HIV, HIV/AIDS, and how it likely made the jump from the animal to the human worlds. It's kind of illustrative of the kind of thing you're hoping, trying to stop.
That's exactly right. And many people, when they think about the beginning of the AIDS pandemic, they'll place it somewhere in the early 80s, right around 1981. But in fact, 1981 was only the point in time when the symptoms of AIDS were first actually seen. The virus actually entered into human populations much earlier. In fact, as much as perhaps 100 years or more ago. And we actually know a remarkable amount about the origins of HIV, and we're learning more and more each day about how it enters into how it probably entered into humans.
I've read that epidemiologists now theorize that as far back as the 1930s, you say maybe longer ago than that, somewhere in equatorial Africa, a hunter may have killed a chimp. Butchered it in the jungle, or at least partly cut himself in that process. The blood mingles, the chimp blood viruses in the chimp blood enter the human bloodstream, and so it begins. But what's happening in that encounter that constitutes the beginning of a pandemic, Nathan?
Well, you're exactly right, Tom. HIV, the main form of HIV that's spread around the world in humans, is actually a chimpanzee virus that entered into people. And what's going on in that interaction, and interactions that take place just like that interaction every day in many parts of the world, is close contact between the blood and body fluids of animals. And the case of HIV origins, it was a chimpanzee, but in the case of other diseases, it's different animals. And it's this contact permits viruses as well as other infectious agents to move from animals into people. And this kind of thing, interestingly, it actually occurs very commonly. But every once in a while, one of these relatively common occurrences, these sort of jumps over, will lead to a real proper spillover where the agent sticks in humans and spreads and causes a potentially devastating pandemic, as in the case of AIDS.
What's in the case of AIDS, what's the, I don't know, gestation is the wrong word, but you say it may have first begun the jump from animal to human a century ago. What happened in all those decades before it burst out as a pandemic? What was going on during that time? Repeated encounters between hunter and animal blood? Or some morphing of the virus itself that made it more effective in using the humans as a host? How do you picture that?
It's a fascinating question that you've asked, and the answer is we really don't know. What we do know is that all of the evidence, and it's hard to do this kind of research to try to date things back into time, but we do know that we found a couple of viruses in Kinshasa, in Democratic Republic of Congo, from old specimens from the late 50s, early 60s that were preserved, and that there were definitely viruses there. And by comparing the genetic fingerprint of those viruses and of other viruses in humans around the world, we can do some dating that really points us back early in the 20th century, if not earlier. So what happened during that entire period between when the virus jumped over and when it really started going global, which must have been sort of late 60s, 70s, probably, or 80s in that period? Part of it is you have to understand that the world, as you know, has changed very dramatically over the last 50 years, particularly, well, really everywhere, but in terms of Central Africa as well. So there were many sort of small villages, and there continue to be those small villages. But the idea is that perhaps this virus, for a reasonable amount of time, was sort of stuck and restricted to small groups of rural villages or regional areas in Central Africa. But as you start to see the sort of air transport networks building up, planes going everywhere, trucking networks going to move logs in and out of places, these provide the opportunities for viruses that were previously restricted to some small little village somewhere to potentially go global.
You know, I never really thought until I focused on the work that you're doing with the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative. I never really thought of wildlife around the world as sort of, you know, walking and flying threats to human health, their bloodstream, the viruses that they should carry. Now, why is it that viruses carried, whether in Central Africa or in Southeast Asia, why are they a potential threat to human health?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Part of the reality is that there are a tremendous amount of viruses in the world. And believe it or not, most of these viruses are quite benign, and many of them are probably even very useful. But it is the case that all of the major diseases that we really know of, where their origins come from, mostly that suggests that they do have animal origins. Okay, so I mean, it could be the case that our ancestors passed some diseases on to us, but what we find when we do a review of all the major diseases, that most of them do come from animals.
Malaria, smallpox, West Nile, Ebola, SARS, avian influenza, that's a long list.
It really is a long list. It is a long list. I mean, I do think it's also important to point out that humans also represent a pretty substantial risk to animal populations at the same time. I mean, if you think about humans now, we're now this incredibly populous species. We exist sort of in every nook and cranny of the planet. So increasingly, you have small populations of animals that are spread out. And when those populations become endangered or threatened, the sort of number of viruses that we've accumulated now in our sort of world travels and interconnectivity also represent threats to those animal populations. So it really does go in both ways. But certainly animals are key to this process.
You want to move our early warning system for outbreaks or surges of dangerous viruses deeper in to the natural world. How would your surveillance work? We're going to go to Cameroon before too long. But for example, in Africa, how does the surveillance of your network actually work on the ground?
That's a great question. And I mean, for us, part of this is really getting to the source. Okay, so if you think about something like Ebola, okay, whenever you hear about the reporting of Ebola, you always hear about it being reported from these, you know, relatively large towns of 10,000 individuals or so. And when we really were thinking about that, we were thinking, gosh, we know this part of the world, and there's very few towns out there that are at 10,000 individuals. So it must have been sort of bubbling along, percolating. These outbreaks must be out there, and there must be many little ones that we're missing. And only when it becomes a bigger one do we actually catch it. And by then, it's getting closer to being too late. And so our idea is to go to the source, and it is this interface between animals and humans, the point where you have contact between animals and humans. And for us, we were fascinated by regions of the world that have a lot of biodiversity. You can kind of think about them as hot spots for the emergence of new viruses, because these are the places where there's a diversity of everything, whether it be plants or animals or viruses. And then what we did is we decided to work in those places with the people who had the most contact with animals. In our case, for example, we started a lot of this work in Central Africa. I did earlier work in Asia, but this this project was actually started in Africa. And so we were focused there with populations that hunt. And I should emphasize, these are people who hunt really pretty much to feed themselves and their families.
And they're hunting bushmeat, as it's widely called. But they're hunting wild animals in the rainforest in Central Africa.
That's right. I mean, like populations everywhere in the world, they hunt wild game. So in the same sort of way that that you might sort of eat venison here in the States, or frankly, sushi, which is a form of wild game. We probably should call that bush meat as well. But certainly people in Central Africa, they also rely on wild game. And to a certain extent, in many parts of Central Africa where you don't have extensive livestock, then there really is a tremendous amount of dependence on wild game. And while it varies from place to place, people around the world generally will hunt the majority of animals that happen to be local. And in Central Africa, that includes a wide range of animals.
And this draws your attention because it's a bloody business. The blood of the hunted animal is spilled and maybe mingled with the blood of a hunter who's been running through forest, may have their own open wounds at the time. So there's insight into the viruses in the animal's blood and also into the human hunter's blood.
That's right, Tom. And sort of sitting here in Stanford, California, in this part of my life, people really are very distanced from the process of butchering, and we forget what it looks like. But when you butcher an animal, this is not an easy process. This is a process that involves a lot of potential contact with blood and other tissues.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with pandemic hunter Nathan Wolfe about his search for the next killer virus in the rainforests of Africa and beyond, about stopping killer viruses before they get beyond the wild game hunter's bloody hand, searching in jungle and outback for first signs of the next HIV, the next Ebola. Nathan Wolfe is a professor at Stanford and director of the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative. You can see photos of the group's work and some of the hunting we're describing here at our website, onpointradio.org. And I should say, just to give a sense of the scale and importance attached to this, Nathan, you've got funding now from Google, from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Skoll Foundation, National Geographic, the U.S. Department of Defense. There's a lot of focus on this. Why so much, Nathan?
Well, I think people are now increasingly recognizing that the sort of older approach where you just wait for a virus to become a pandemic and then attempt to respond through vaccines or drugs, it's just not going to be sufficient. The cost of HIV to the human population in terms of lives lost, in terms of economic consequences, is so incredible. And even smaller pandemics like SARS, SARS, even when it caused, only maybe 1,000 or so cases, the impact on the global economy was measured in the billions of dollars. So we need to get better at this. We need to be focused not only on responding to pandemics once they actually exist and are spread throughout the world, but at least spending a percentage of our effort trying to stop them. And I think people are increasingly recognizing that.
Now, the process for tracking the virus, listening to viral chatter, you call it, is what? I mean, this is not rocket science exactly. At some level, it's very sort of down and dirty, out in the woods, in the villages work. But then it comes to a lot of analysis back stateside. What's the flow of information here?
That's right. And I love the phrase viral chatter, which was coined by my mentor, Don Burke. And the idea of it is just that in the same way that you have intelligence chatter. So intelligence chatter is the idea that you could be out there. You could be monitoring, for example, email communication, cell phone communication, if you were a government. And you could be looking for certain key words that would indicate a possible terrorist event. Maybe bomb would be too generic, but a specific kind of, plastic explosive would indicate, okay, well, this communication is sensitive. We better respond to that, and maybe we can stop a terrorist event. Now, that's just the same idea of viral chatter. And what we're in the process of doing is creating listening points all throughout the world. And the idea is that at these listening points, we're watching as these viruses are pinging us, as these animal agents are entering into human populations. Many of them will be useless, okay? Many, because like many times that you hear the word bomb, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a terrorist event. But what we're trying to do is to study this and watch everything that's flowing over, but then to look carefully. Does this one fall into the same category as viruses like retroviruses that caused HIV? Is this a new malaria parasite? If so, then we better watch those things. Or does it cause disease? Is it capable of spreading? You know, so many of these things will cross over. You know, I mean, just like when you, when people touch a dog or kiss a dog, as you sometimes see now in the States, for example, at that moment, there are microbes that are passing over from that dog to the human. Now, most of those are going to be, you know, completely useless from a perspective of spreading or causing disease. But every once in a while, some sort of contact with some animal will lead to the cross-species transmission or movement or jumping of a bug over into people that will be important. But what we want to do is sort of really get a sense of all of it, and particularly in the hot spots where we know these things jump.
Nathan Wolf, please stand by in California. I want to go to one of those hot spots, one of your listening points with the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative. We're joined right now from Cameroon, from Yaoundé, Cameroon, by your colleague there, Matthew LeBreton, ecology coordinator for the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative in Cameroon, where he's been working since the year 2000. Matthew, can you hear us? Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi, thank you very much for your time today. Can you describe to us how you work there with local hunters to collect blood samples from their hunting expeditions that help inform this network of listening posts we're hearing about? How does it actually work, Matthew?
Yeah, Tom, we've set up a system where we can collect samples in fairly isolated areas. So we're talking about areas that might take a day or even longer to drive to from the capital city where our lab is based. So these are areas that have very difficult roads to get down. When we get down to the end of these roads, there's no electricity, there's no freezers, there's no real capacity to be able to develop a lab to store these samples. So we've set up a system where we use small bits of laboratory paper, standard laboratory paper, to collect dried blood spots from the animals that are hunted in these rural areas. So these samples are collected by the hunters themselves during the times that they're hunting and butchering the animals. And they keep them in the village, keep them dry, and keep them clean for us. And we come by and collect them every so often and bring them back into our lab in Yaoundé. And from there, we then send them on to the lab where we can do the analysis to see what kinds of different microorganisms, different types of microbes that we can find within those samples that they've collected for us.
Matthew, what kind of animals might these hunters be hunting in Cameroon? Can you tell us some species that they would look for? They're looking for subsistence for meat, like what?
Well, I mean, Central African forests are incredible places, huge diversity of all kinds of different animals. So the majority of the animals that people hunt here will be things like porcupines and different types of large forest rodents, large rats. And other things like pangolins and small antelopes, monkeys, really all kinds of different animals that you find in the forest here in Central Africa. And these areas, like I say, are incredibly diverse. You have probably somewhere between 100 and 200 different species of animals, depending on the specific location where you are.
Are the hunters suspicious of you when you come into their small village asking them to bring you samples of blood from their prey?
Well, of course, we don't just kind of walk up in a village and ask people to give us blood from animals. We do it within the context of a fairly comprehensive education program looking at helping hunters to understand, hunters and people who are butchering, so, different sections of the community, to help them understand what are different microbes, what are different viruses and other infections that these wild animals might have, and what steps they can take to avoid being infected by those microbes. And it's within that context, then, that we offer to collaborate with them, to collect these samples and tell them more about the particular animals that they have in their particular forest.
Now, do you also take blood samples from the hunters, then, to see if you're finding the same viruses in prey and hunter?
Yes, that's a really important part of what we do. It's looking at both sides, looking at the wild animals and seeing what's the diversity, the different microbes that we find in wild animals out in the forest, and also look in the people who are exposed to those animals, so we can then start to look at, from all of that diversity, from all of those different microbes in the forest, which ones have actually crossed over into humans. And I think, you know, that's one of the important steps before we can then start to categorize those infections and say, this is one that we should be careful of. And I think Nathan was talking about that earlier. This is something we should be watching out for in terms of something that might spread from person to person and go on to cause a pandemic in the future.
Are some animal species more likely than others to produce viruses that are dangerous to humans? For example, primates, animals who are closer to humans in their genetic makeup, are they a more dangerous as potential hosts for pathogens dangerous to humans?
That's a really great point. And that kind of brings me to something kind of really fundamental in our program as well, that you do have animals that are more risky for people. And it is those animals that are most closely related to humans. So the chimpanzees and the gorillas and the other types of monkeys that occur in these forests. And that opens up a window for us to be able to introduce a health message that's also a really important conservation message. Chimpanzees and gorillas and a number of primates are endangered here in Central Africa, and it allows us to bring in a health message that doubles up with the conservation message and the law enforcement message that chimpanzees shouldn't be hunted. There's a good reason for conservation. There's a good reason because it's against the law, and there's also a really good reason for your health, for your safety, to avoid contact with those kinds of animals. It's nice to be able to have a message that works from a number of different perspectives in that sense.
Nathan Wolf in California. So you're getting these blood samples then, I assume, at some point shipped back to the States, and you're tracking them for their, I don't know if viral load is the right phrase here, but for the viruses that show up looking for what might be dangerous, like what?
Well, actually, the basic idea of our initiative is to link together these sorts of field sites in Cameroon and elsewhere with a really diverse group of laboratories, one of which, for example, is in Yaoundé in Cameroon, mm-hmm. But others are in France and Malaysia and the States. And the idea is, the way that we approach this is we sort of, if you think about the world of microbes as sort of a universe, there's going to be a lot of different galaxies out there. And some of these galaxies are going to be ones that we know, like, say, the retroviruses that has a star in that that's HIV. And we know that's a nasty virus. So we're really focused on these sort of known galaxies that we know can cause pandemics. And in those galaxies, we really focused on going out and identifying all the unknown stars there and to try to make sure that we know what are the retroviruses that are out there. Same would be for malaria parasites. But then we work with other laboratory groups that are actually focused on finding completely unknown galaxies out there. And there is some absolutely amazing science. We work with colleagues like Forrest Roer at San Diego and Eric Delwart and Joe DeRisi at San Francisco, Ian Lipkin. And these people are doing this absolutely incredible science where they go out there and they're actually, their objective is to find completely unknown galaxies. And the molecular techniques that allow us to do that now are pretty amazing.
Matthew LeBreton in Cameroon, we just have you for another minute. Do you have the sense in your work there, working with hunters deep in the forest very often, that you're watching an enormous flow of potentially dangerous viruses, or is it that one in a million or fewer that presents a real threat to human health?
Well, I guess it's difficult to kind of, I mean, when you're in these places, you don't really see anything happening, you know, other than in the contact with the blood. The viruses are kind of something really difficult to see in that kind of process. But what we have is a great opportunity to be able to put up some really, really easy suggestions, really easy ways that people can prevent these microbes from crossing over and can really contribute to preventing a pandemic from happening in the future.
Well, we wish you good luck with that and with all your work there in Central Africa. Matthew LeBreton at the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative Center in Cameroon, Yaoundé, Cameroon. Thank you very much for being with us, Matthew.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Let's begin to hear from our listeners in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Aidan's calling. Aidan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling in regards to there was a new hemorrhagic fever that was discovered a couple weeks ago. And I'm not sure the country, but it was in southern Africa, and I believe three aid workers died, and it's same regards as Ebola or Marburg, but it was a different strain of them, or just a different bacteria altogether,
okay.
virus altogether.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you had any information on that, if there was anything new that's coming up that's on the radar right now.
Nathan, I don't know this story, but has this shown up in the viral chatter you're following?
Actually, this particular story has not, but there increasingly are very interesting tools. And I think I should point out that sort of our approach is one of a growing number of approaches to addressing this problem. And some of them are based in information technology. For example, there's this organization called ProMed out there, and they sort of scan all the news feeds from all over the world. And the idea for us is to try to link in with some of this, you know, so our initiative links with people who are, you know, scanning the internet for evidence, like our colleagues at Google.org or folks at HealthMap. And we try to sort of, I think what you can envision is in the future there will be a better capacity, because the particular outbreak that that the viewer has mentioned, often, believe it or not, it can take up to 100 days for the current sort of global health infrastructure to respond to outbreaks like that. And that, frankly, is just, it's just too long. We need to find ways, creative ways, maybe ways that will involve initiatives like our own that are non-governmental approaches to more rapidly responding to outbreaks. But this is definitely a critical need.
Aidan, thanks for your call. Let's go to Mireille in Hollis, New Hampshire. Mireille, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
And hello to your guest. I haven't just caught the show in the passing. I don't know his name. But my question is, I read Hot Zone, and I'd like to know if these viruses like Ebola and AIDS are not due to the disturbance of the ecosystems, you know, with the hunting safaris up in the 50s, 60s, and then the poaching that's, you know, succeeded in Africa.
In other words, is it because of human disruption of the animal world?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I'm thinking maybe there was like an organism that was maybe eating those viruses that disappeared, so that maybe they jumped into the human race.
Mireille, let us pick it up. Nathan Wolf, can you imagine somehow that the human imprint on the natural world, beyond just being there to be a host for transmission, but somehow creates the environment or circumstances that produces the pathogen, produces the disease?
It's a fascinating question, and it's right on. And the reality is that, yes, contemporary elements of human society and aspects of globalization are changing the rate at which novel agents pass from animals into humans. Now, this has been occurring sort of throughout human history, so the fact that things jump into us is not new. But what is new is the number of human beings that exist, the reach that we have into the depth of very biodiverse regions that have a lot of pathogens in them, and the networks that are created. Right now, if you take a look at air flights throughout the world, you can get from sort of deep in Central Africa to New York City or to Tokyo in the course of 24 hours or 48 hours. And what that means is previously those things that might have gone extinct in a local village, you know, sort of entered in and swept through the village, killing some people, not killing other people, and then just disappeared. Those things now have the potential to enter into the larger human population. So I think it's a very insightful question, and it's absolutely the case.
But what you're talking about is sending up a flare early so that there could be some kind of intervention. The intervention itself is not your work. You're the surveillance system, I guess.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we are focused exclusively, and we have a very sort of focused mission. And our mission is to understand how pandemics are born, and also to try to work to see the patterns in which their sources are and how they're born, and come up with systems to more quickly identify the threats, and then to work with other organizations to stop those threats before they become pandemics.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with pandemic hunter Nathan Wolf about his search for the next killer virus in the rainforests of Africa and beyond, searching in jungle and outback for first signs of the next HIV, the next Ebola. Nathan Wolf joins us from Stanford. California. He spent many years working in Asia and Africa, tracking down just the kind of viruses we're talking about today. He's director of the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative. Nathan, I've got questions coming in here. One, over the at the website, onpointradio.org, where I should say again, listeners can see a collection of photographs of your work and the kind of hunting we've been talking about. Kate asks, what is the potential role of the exotic pet trade in the spread of viruses? Nathan?
Excellent. Absolutely very important. And some people will remember actually a very important outbreak of monkeypox, which is a virus that comes from Central Africa here in the States that was associated with the import of pet rodents from West Africa. So absolutely, any time that animals are moved from place to place, they're also going to be moved with the various viruses and other agents that they carry. And those will represent very important points of possible crossover, perhaps in new environments where they may be able to spread more rapidly.
Now, when SARS was an issue and avian influenza, we heard not so much about hunting, but we heard about raising of, you know, ducks and chickens and sort of mucky pens here and there around the world. Is that an equal target of your surveillance, or do you have a special interest in the hunted side, a reason to think that's more important?
Tom, thanks for pointing that out, and I think that that's a really important point. Our work in Central Africa is mostly with hunters, and the reason is because that's where the contact occurs. But that's by no means the only contact that occurs. In places in Asia, for example, it can be these sort of wet markets or live animal markets. Mm-hmm. It may be people who work in restaurants or in the animal trade. It may also be people who, say, handle birds, bird handlers in Alaska doing scientific research, or wildlife veterinarians. So there's nothing, particular from our perspective about the population. What we want is people who are in regions that we think have important biodiversity, the sort of hot spots, if you will, and those individuals who really have a lot of contact with animals. Those are the people we want in our system.
Let's go to Jenny in Randolph, Vermont. Hi, Jenny. You're on the air with Nathan Wolf.
Hi, Tom. Nathan, I just had a concern and a question. Because you've been focusing on the bushmeat trade quite a bit in your conversation. And my understanding from information from the Goodall Institute is that the bushmeat trade isn't just a subsistence hunting issue. It's really turned into a very large commercial business. And so I wanted to make sure that, I don't know if you disagree with that, perhaps not in Cameroon, but I know at least in the Congo, they've documented that it's there's 10 times more bushmeat sold than the commercial ventures in a subsistence hunting. And so not only do I have a concern as someone who wants to see wildlife protected, and especially endangered and threatened species, but also in terms of transmission of diseases, if it's really become, if that bushmeat is sold all over the world, which the Goodall Institute claims it is, I guess I'm wondering if you would agree with those characterizations, and also if you're working with groups like the Goodall Institute to try to implement programs in these countries. I know they try to work with the local villagers to have alternatives.
To cut down on that hunting. Nathan Wolf, how about it?
It's a really important point. Now, we specifically have chosen to work with subsistence hunters for a number of different reasons, but it is very important to point out that there is commercial hunting. The actual sort of number of animals that are hunted through subsistence hunting actually, in fact, is probably much greater than commercial hunting, but there is commercial hunting. It's almost exclusively illegal, particularly for endangered species, and it is a huge threat and a huge problem.
Is it really for export beyond the local markets?
You know, I don't know, Tom, you know, but there definitely is, there's a tremendous problem of commercial hunting. And we specifically have chosen not to focus on working with commercial hunters, but we do have longstanding collaborations with a number of conservation organizations, just like the Jane Goodall organization. For example, we work with a Wildlife Conservation Society. And my work in Asia was focused with Billy Karish and the folks over there. So it's the issues of conservation are critical to us. And as sort of Matt was describing, a big factor for us is trying to change the way that people are addressing some of these conservation issues by injecting health as an important factor.
But do you foresee a time when bushmeat hunting goes away as a significant source for food in these communities, or is it just it's always going to be there with its risk of cross-transmission?
I think that as a global community, we need to take very, very seriously issues of rural development in Central Africa. I think this issue of bushmeat, if you like to call it that, is at the center of major conservation crisis, you know, having some of our closest relatives go extinct, the emergence of pandemics, things like HIV, and also food security, because these are not sustainable. So these populations will be left without food. So I think that we sort of avoid addressing this bushmeat issue at our own peril as a global society. But I think it's a challenging thing, because really what's needed is profound development in rural parts of Central Africa and focusing on really giving people alternatives. Because if you just come in and say, well, this is a species that we think is very important, or even if you say that there's health consequences associated with hunting, people are going to say, well, you know, feeding my child is a little bit more important. Now, this is, again, the subsistence side of it, not the commercial trade, which is very different. But I think what's required is, you know, is really much more attention to be paid on this. This is not a boutique, only conservation issue. That's an important part of it. But this is about preventing pandemics, and it's about major food security issues. We need to be focused in these communities, and we as a planet need to find solutions, maybe outside-of-the-box solutions, but conduct major investment in trying to change the way that these activities occur in Central Africa. I think that's vitally important.
Jenny, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Los Angeles, California, and Saad. Saad, you're on the air with Nathan Wolf.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, with so many emerging new pathogenic viruses, how can you be able to identify lab-wise, if you don't know the genetic structure or serologically in patients, how can you identify these viruses if you've never seen them before, if you've never known their genetic makeup?
It's a great question. Nathan, give us some sense of what sends a flare-up to you. What are you looking for when you peer into all the blood, let's say, that comes into the labs?
Well, it's a really good question. It sort of goes back to whether the things that we're looking at are sort of from a known galaxy, if they're related to things that we already know about, or those sort of unknown galaxies, those viruses out there that we really just don't have a sense of. And some of the most amazing new techniques are focused on those unknown galaxies, and they do some pretty amazing things. In some of them, and you know, this is work done by colleagues of ours like Joe DeRisi and Ian Lipkin, they create literally on a single slide chip lots and lots of different viruses, as many viruses as we know about. And they on each one of those spots, if you take a specimen from a person who's sick and you put it on one of those slides, the little viruses that are known, if it actually corresponds to something that's roughly known, it'll light up. And then there's even newer techniques using sequencing. And essentially, So these take a look at the genetic signatures of viruses, and some of these techniques are absolutely mind-blowing in their ability to take a specimen, whether it be sort of a drop of water or blood. And what they do is, by using a tool called PCR, polymerase chain reaction, but they apply it in a generic way. So instead of the normal PCR, which is these little probes that look for a very specific signature of DNA, this sort of random amplification PCR, sort of this random PCR, uses every possible combination of probes. And what it does is it means that almost anything that is genetic information in that sample will actually be sequenced, potentially at least. And these techniques are still early in their development. But once that becomes the case, then it becomes a problem for, you know, people who are doing the bioinformatics that are looking, you know, using computers to sort the data out and say, you know, what of this genetic information, it looks like a virus. And it's a very challenging technique, but for those of us in the field it's phenomenally exciting because what it means is sort of the first time in human history we have the capacity to understand this vast world of microorganisms that arguably are the dominant forms of life on our planet and which we still understand very little of.
And would you spot a dangerous viral pathogen by its particular genetic character or by, let's say, its speed of replication by its population? Do you think does it look dangerous because it's suddenly spiking, showing up everywhere, or because it has a particular, a menacing profile to human health?
It's a fascinating question. And, our hope is that these questions will increasingly be answered as this sort of science of pandemic prevention expands in the coming years. But there are a couple clues that we have even right now, sort of early on. You know, for example, as I said, knowing that it comes from a family that causes pandemics, you know, that it's a pox virus like smallpox, or that it's, that it's a retrovirus like HIV, or there are certain larger groups of viruses which seem to be more associated with pandemics. There are these small RNA viruses that have really incredible capacity to create genetic diversity, novelty in their genetic code, either through recombining with other viruses or just having very high rates of error, high rates of mutation. And those tend to be also interesting viruses to look at. But there's likely to be many other sort of drivers, if you will, things out there that are associated with pandemics. And there's a wide group of science which is now being supported by groups like Google.org and the Skoll Foundation to be looking for in different kinds of ways, using different kinds of approaches to really address these problems. And I think, it's very exciting as we look to the future, both scientifically, but I think also the potential. Look, if we spend the next 20 or 30 years and we avert even one pandemic, the cost savings and the savings of lives will be so phenomenal. The investment will be so worthwhile. So it's not like, and it doesn't even have to be preventing a pandemic, literally early warning over the course of years. I mean, I just want you to think for a moment about the HIV pandemic, okay? AIDS was discovered, it was really sort of identified in 1981. Now imagine, what if we knew before 1981 that there was this obscure virus, perhaps? It was maybe a boutique virus at that point, something unusual, but it was in Africa. It was spreading. We knew that it spread. Maybe we had some diagnostics. Well, then it wouldn't have taken us 2 years to identify after 1981 the virus that caused AIDS, or 5 years for the president of the United States to be able to say the word AIDS because of, political concerns, right? We would have known so much more about it. And each of those years that we would have had advance warning, we could have saved so many lives. And maybe here 30 years out into the pandemic, we'd be looking at 4 million infections as opposed to 40 million infections. So this is really, I think it's something that we need to think very carefully about. And, by no means, there's a number of groups out there that are approaching this in different ways. We all need to be out there doing this kind of thing. From a scientific perspective, I think the people in this community, we need to really be taking these things seriously.
It's a persuasive argument. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and Justin. Justin, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
You're focusing on, Africa and stuff, and I was just wondering if there's, North American diseases, wasting disease and wandering disease in the elk and deer population that are very similar to, mad cow disease and, Swiss cheese holes in the brains kind of thing.
It's a great question. Nathan, I wondered the same, why the focus seems so often over there. What about the large populations of life and wildlife right here in North America? Are there issues there as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I mean, our focus, has been on regions where sort of if you do this sort of work like our colleagues at Consortium for Conservation Medicine have done these great reviews, and there do seem to be some particular hotspots which are associated with the emergence of novel viruses. And so because resources are limited, we focus most of our energy there, but by no means are viruses emerging exclusively from those regions. For example, here in the sort of Four Corners region of the Southwest, there was a very important Hanta virus outbreak which occurred. So, the capacity for viruses to move over is not exclusive to some particular region. There's not continents which are necessarily, they may be associated with more outbreaks, but it's not exclusive to any place. This is a global phenomenon.
Let me get one more call from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Landon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey, Nathan. My question is pertaining to what the role of healthcare professionals will be in identifying these emerging diseases. And also, I also work in DNA sequencing for Harvard Partners, and we do a lot of sequencing of past pandemic and epidemic diseases. And I'm wondering what the implications are of having that type of information for identifying new ones.
And when you say land in healthcare workers, you mean them identifying these when they come across a human who's already suffering some kind of disease problem as a result of contact or transmission?
Correct. So the nurses and doctors that would identify a patient that might have symptoms, what would their role be in the process of identifying?
Nathan, are you hoping to identify this before it even gets to that point? But surely there's a chain either way.
No, that's right. And we have a whole range of partners that we work with all along this this continuum, from the actual individuals who have contact with these animals all the way up through that. And actually, it might be useful if you're interested in seeing sort of this group of partners that we collaborate with. You can also have a look at our website, which is lastpandemic.org.
Lastpandemic.org. And the issue of the history of DNA sequencing, are you looking back into kind of a great reference library to judge what you're looking at today?
Well, I do think accumulating, libraries, whether it be of collections or DNA sequences, is absolutely critical. For us right now, we're really focused on the hard task ahead, which is to take these sites, which, were supported early on through work from the National Institutes of Health, to get us started in these places and to actually make them, invest in these places to have them be appropriate early warning centers.
Well, we're getting a whole new sense of what it may take to monitor global health and pandemics in a truly globalized age. Nathan Wolf is director of the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative. We heard earlier from his colleague Matthew LeBreton in Yaoundé, Cameroon. Nathan Wolf in Stanford, California, thank you very much for your work and thanks for describing it to us this hour. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.